nanohub.org. You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Enjoy the show.
The basic phenomena that we are talking about, if you remember, as I said, we have been talking about current flow in small devices, and a totally new class of things opens up when you consider devices with magnetic contacts. Contacts that actually allow you to inject one type of spin preferentially over another. And the idea being that magnets are these very special materials where the density of states is different for the two types of spins. What that means is if you have two levels inside your channel, one of upspin and one of downspin, the upspin will be able to get out a little more easily into the contact than the downspin. On the other hand, if the magnet were turned around, that would be reversed. So what these contacts give you is the ability to inject spins preferentially. And ideally, of course, what you'd like is perfect contacts, ones that only inject one type of spin. Now, to my knowledge, that's not really been achieved yet, although over the last 10 years, it's continually kept improving. Okay. Now, we had discussed, I think, before the break, if you remember, we discussed some properties that you could understand fairly simply, just by thinking of it as two channels. You got an upspin channel and a downspin channel, and you can understand why you observe this magnetoresistance, for example. That is, if one magnet turns around, actually the current goes down. And that's a very important effect that's widely used, actually. Okay. Now, as I mentioned before, there is also a whole class of phenomena that require a we discuss some of the more subtle aspects of spin. And in this context, as I had mentioned, the best analogy I know in terms of something that you are already familiar with is the polarization of light. And that is that you could compare a device like this with what's widely used in optics, something called an electro-optic modulator. How does that work? It works like this. You have a polarizer here and an analyzer here. So what a polarizer does is when light comes in with all kinds of polarization, it lets one particular polarization go in. So let's say the one pointing this way. And if the analyzer is in the same direction, then the light would go right through. On the other hand, if the analyzer is 90 degrees, then it would stop the light. So let's say the analyzer is in the same direction, so light goes right through. And then they have this special material inside, this electro-optic modulator, where if you put an electric field, you can actually make the polarization rotate inside. So as it goes through that material, because of the properties of that material, its refractive index has a very special property, because of which an electric field makes this polarization rotate. And if it rotates out to 90 degrees, then it will be completely stopped. And that's how you turn off the light. That's a widely used device in optics. And in a way, the devices we are talking about here could be viewed as an analog of that, an electronic analog. Here it's light, here it's electrons. And what these contacts are sort of like polarizer and analyzer. In fact, lots of times in the literature, people use those words. They say, now, refer to one, the two contacts we usually talk about as source and drain. But in this context, sometimes people call it a polarizer and an analyzer because of this analogy that they have in mind. Now, one important difference, and that kind of tells you the essential difference between these vectors and spinors, that is, why spins are not just like optical polarization. That important difference is that, you see, when light comes in order to block it, you'd have to turn this analyzer by 90 degrees. In order to block the spin, you have to turn it by 180 degrees. It's twice as big the angle. Okay? And in terms of the math, the way it is reflected is, when you take a vector pointing in some direction, and you want to write, say, its x component and its z component, and let's assume for the moment that the vector is in the xz plane, then these components in x and z, you'd write as cosine theta and sine theta. On the other hand, the spins, the math, the way it works is, when you write its x and z component, again, for the moment, let's assume it's in the y, it's in the xz plane, you'd write what you might call an up component and a down component. It's not xyz anymore, it's like up and down components, and those components would be written as cosine half theta and sine half theta. And that half is, of course, the important thing. But here, when you go 90 degrees, what is 1, 0 becomes 0, 1. Here, you have to go 180 degrees in order to turn 1, 0 into 0, 1, two components. Right? Now, when you have a y component also, so if the vector that you're thinking of in your mind that's pointing in some direction, if it's not in the zx plane, if it's, say, no, also has a y component, then you put that in here, and that's also like sine theta, and you have a cosine phi and a sine phi. So usually when you think of a vector, the way you visualize it is that, there's the z direction, that's the x direction, and in the spherical coordinates, as you know, when you think of this vector, it's pointing in some direction that you call theta from the z axis. And then if you project it on the xy plane, then whatever angle it makes with the x-axis, that's what's called phi. So theta is this angle with the z-axis, and then in the xy plane, that angle, that's the phi. That's how you normally visualize this vector. So the point to be clear on is, it's like mentally you have a vector that points in some direction, which you are writing in terms of its components. And what you learned somewhere in your freshman year or earlier is that the components of the vector in spherical coordinates are given by cosine theta, sine theta, cosine phi, sine theta, sine phi. And what most of you have not seen before is another way of writing this thing, this two-component representation with cosine half theta and sine half theta, which is relevant for treating spins. And, of course, the phi also enters here. The phi enters in the following way. You have e to the power minus I phi over 2 and e to the power plus I phi over 2. So here you have three real components. Here you have two complex components. Okay. But either this scheme or this scheme allows you to represent, to associate a particular set of components with anything that you can imagine here. And the point is that often people go back and forth between these things. You need this in order to include spin into the Schrodinger equation. On the other hand, because this isn't as familiar, the way people like to think about it often is in terms of a vector, of an equivalent vector. That to every spinner, there's a vector in your mind that you kind of think in terms of. So they always say, you know, I have a spin that's pointing like this, but then they'll write something like this. See? Okay. Now, in the Schrodinger equation, the way it enters is the following, that if you think of some vector m, and you want to write its how the up and down components of that vector evolve, mu and md. What I mean is, m is this, is this vector that we have in our mind, and it has an up component and it has a down component. Just as if you wrote it in this way, you'd have an x component and a y component and a z component. So, alternatively, we could have tried to write something like this, d dt of mx, my, and mz. Now, in the Schrodinger equation, the way it enters, if you have a magnetic field in the z direction, then what happens is the up component has a, the energy is, say, goes up. So I'll put a plus one, and here I'll put a minus one. And the magnitude, the overall magnitude of this, let me write it out front, is mu b times dc. So this is the magnetic field that you have introduced, that you have applied, and mu b is this Bohr magneton. As I mentioned, like before the break, in a way, one way to think about it is as if every electron is like a magnet, and an up component denotes something that's along plus z, down component is like along minus z, and the energy is the magnetization times the magnetic field, mu b times bz. And how were these measured? As I mentioned before, the seminal experiment in this field, of course, is this famous Stern-Gerlach experiment. And what that showed was that in an inhomogeneous magnetic field, the two electrons split into two beams, and by how much it deflected, one could measure how much that should be, etc. Anyway, the point I want to make here is then that if you take this equation, it's like you could write in one line the solution to this. Why is that? Because there are no off-diagonal elements, so it separates easily into two equations. And the corresponding solution you could write as, if you look at the up component, it would look like whatever it is at time equals 0 times exponential u b b z over I h bar. And similarly, you could write m down . So this easily splits into two equations, and you can write the solution easily. It's an exponential. And one point I made, you know, before the break when we discussed this, is that if you look at this, you can immediately see that this spin, when you apply a magnetic field, it is rotating around the z-axis. How do you see that? Well, that is, if you accept this, namely, that the components of this thing, there's a theta here, and then there is this angle phi down here. Now, what it shows, if you compare this solution, let me write that here, so you'd, this up and down component, instead of going back and forth from left to right, let me just write it here. If you compare these, what it's telling you is that as you look at a later time, the up component and the down component, the magnitude hasn't changed. What has changed is this phase part of it. And if you compare with this, what it tells you is that the theta remains fixed while the phi keeps changing with time. If you because these are the up and down components, m up and m down. So what you could, if you compare that solution is this, what it tells you is that as you go along in time, the theta remains fixed, which is why what's in front here remains fixed. That is whatever you started with. But then as time goes on, the phi keeps changing with time like that. So what that means, of course, is that, you know, if you remember our definition of phi and theta is this angle, so that's fixed. So you're at a fixed angle with the z-axis, but the projection on the xy plane is changing. So what that means is you're really just rotating around the z-axis. Right? So you're just going around, keeping theta fixed. So this is the z-axis. The theta is fixed. You're rotating around it. Right? And the phi keeps changing. That's what this tells you.
So yes.
Fixed. For this discussion, let's say we just have a fixed magnetic field in some direction.
But even if we don't have this magnetic field, the electron will be spinning while going from left to right.
Now, when you say spinning, that's kind of a figurative term. But the thing is that if the spin, let's say, came in at some direction, that magnet, then if there's no magnetic field, it will just go along keeping that direction fixed. Now, that direction itself you might associate mentally with some spinning, that's a separate issue. Right? Whereas here what we are saying is, if you come in, say, this way, and you apply a magnetic field like this in this direction, let's say, you come in this way, then the magnet itself will keep turning. Okay? That's what this is telling you. So the bottom line of all this is that what the Schrodinger equation tells you, that is, if you put in a term like this into your Hamiltonian, mu b times bc, what it will lead to is it will cause the spin to be precessing around the z-axis. And the rate at which it will precess, let me write that down here. The rate at which it will precess is given by this thing up here, mu b bz over h bar. Times t. Or I could write it as d phi dt. So this sort of leads you to that conclusion. Provided, of course, you accept in the first place that the components are given by this. Okay? That's all. Okay, so now the next thing I wanted to show you is that, well, this is how you'd write the differential equation in terms of these two spin components. But supposing we wanted to write a differential equation for the components of the vector itself, these three components, the way you normally represent a vector, what would this look like? Okay. So what I'd like to do is, just as you could describe the precession of the spin with this 2x2 differential equation, you could also have written a 3x3 like this in terms of the three components of the equivalent vector. And the question is, what would this one be? And the way you can see what this one would be is, if you take these and see the phi is changing with time. So let us try to write dmx dt first. So, now let me try to write the first line, the dmx dt. So mx is sine theta cosine phi. Theta does not change. Phi is changing with time. So I could write that as dmx dt would be sine theta sine phi minus, and then d phi dt. By the way, I think I missed a 2 there, right? Thank you. Because what happens is there's a I phi over 2 here. So it was phi over 2 that was equal to mu bz over h bar. So the phi is actually equal to 2 times that. That's it. Okay. Now, sine theta sine phi is actually my. So I could take this off and write it as minus my. That's that. Similarly, if I write dmy dt, I'd get sine theta cosine phi and then d phi dt. And sine theta cosine phi is just mx. So I'd get plus mx and then 2 mu b bz over h bar. And what about dmz dt? Can you help me? Zero. Just play zero. So this I could write in matrix form if I wanted. That is, I could write this as, you know, instead of minus my and plus mx, I could write it as 2 mu b bz over h bar times so. Can you help me how I should fill out that matrix? You know, I have minus my 2 mu b bz over h bar. So if I am trying to write this as a matrix times mx, my, mz, what should I put on the first line? 0, minus 1, 0. Similarly, on the second line, I want a plus mx. So I put a plus 1, 0, 0, and then 0, 0. So this would be the equation in terms of spinners. This would be kind of the equation for the equivalent vector, how it rotates. You see? So let me just write that here so you see it. So I'm just rewriting what I had there. Now, so this is the matrix then that leads to rotating this vector around the z-axis. So I could call this, say, Rz. It's the matrix that causes the vector to rotate around the z-axis. Okay? Whereas, in terms of spinners, the similar matrix is this one. Right? There's a bit of a factor between them because I have d dt here. So if I had to write it the same way, I should take the I h bar out from here and put it there. And then there's a 2 there. But other than those little things, I think that matrix kind of plays the same role for these 2 by 2s as this plays for 3 by 3s. See? So that's what you call the rotation matrix for the z-axis. Now, what if you had to write a matrix for rotating around the x-axis? So, for example, if you had put a magnetic field around the x-axis, then you would have expected this vector to be rotating around the x-axis. So, if you wanted to do that, what would the corresponding matrix be? So, instead of this, you'd then have some Rx, right? My question is, what do you think Rx would look like? If you are trying to rotate something around the x-axis, just as this causes a rotation around z. You'd expect that just as there's a zeros here, now there will be zeros here. Because you're rotating around the x-axis. In a way, what you're doing is kind of a transformation of coordinates, where what used to be z is now becoming x. So you're just turning them around, right? So you had x, y, z. And now z is becoming the new x. And so you are sort of permuting them, right? And so y is becoming the new z, and the x is becoming the new y. So you could kind of almost like you're renaming these things. So what would this become? So this is 0. So main thing is this 1 and minus 1. And the only thing is to figure out which way it is. And I think it basically goes cyclically. So if this was minus 1 here, when it comes down here, it will also be minus 1. And this will be 1. That's how it works. So that's easy enough to write down. Now, what's not so easy to write down is what the corresponding thing here would be. You see, this is sigma z. This is for rotating around z axis. What kind of a 2x2 matrix would allow you to rotate around the x axis? And that is kind of what you need, you see, if you had to put a magnetic field in the x direction. Now, usually what happens is lots of problems, you have a magnetic field in a particular direction, and then to simplify your life, you call that the z direction. That way you don't even have to think about what to do with x-directed magnetic fields. But in general, of course, you would have to deal with things that point in arbitrary directions. So the question is, how do I write that matrix then? Okay. Now, this is where, I guess, the way to write it would be using basis transformations. That is, the way I would do it is the following. I'd say that if I were to use, you see, when I write here up and down, it means up and down along z, plus z and minus z. Now, if I were to use plus x and minus x as my basis, then that matrix would have looked exactly the same. So, if I had a magnetic field in the x direction, then what I put into the Hamiltonian would have looked exactly like that if I were using x and minus x as my basis. But of course, I want to use z and minus z as my basis. So, what I need to do is multiply this with these two transformation matrices. This idea of this similarity transformation, which for Hermitian matrices amounts to this unitary transformation, which is that you have some transformation here and something else here that's always the dagger of that. Because for unitary transformations, u dagger is equal to u inverse. So that becomes like the similarity transformation. And the way you write these matrices is that this matrix basically represents x and minus x in terms of z and minus z, whereas this one represents z and minus z in terms of x and minus x. So the whole idea is we started with a matrix in plus x and minus x. That's up along x, up along, down along x. And we're now doing this transformation into plus z and minus z. And as I've mentioned before, the way I write these matrices, the way I remember which one to put here and which one to put there, is that this must match that. So this must match that. When you multiply matrices, multiply these columns into rows. Okay. So of these two matrices then, if I can write down one of them, the other one is just its conjugate transpose. So one way to write this would be, okay, what I told you already is what the up and down components are for a vector that points in any arbitrary direction, theta and phi. So this will allow me to write down this matrix. So for example, I should be able to write down what a plus x looks like in terms of an up and down component, because these up and down are actually plus z and minus z. So how would I write these two components? Well, if I believe in this, then what I need to do is specialize to the case when that vector is in the x direction. So for x direction, what is theta and what is phi? For something pointing in the x direction? I guess I erased that picture, if you remember. If this is z, x means theta is 90 degrees, and phi is just 0. So phi is 0, so that's out of the picture. Theta is 90, so this is cosine 45, this is sine 45, which amounts to 1 over root 2 and 1 over root 2. Right here, 1 over root 2. Now, if I have to write a minus x, that's a little more tricky, because what I gave you here are the components of plus x. Now, in order to go to minus x, what you can show is that instead of theta, you should put pi minus theta. And instead of phi, you should put, I think, pi plus phi. So if you have something here and you want to go over to the negative vector, then if this angle is theta, then the minus one will be like pi minus theta, and it will also have rotated by this angle, so you'd have to add a pi plus phi. That's one way to find the components of minus x. Another way to argue would be, whatever I write here will be orthogonal to this. So if it is 1, 1, you can kind of see it has to be minus 1, 1, or 1, minus 1, one of those. And of course, these vectors usually, you can multiply by any number, that's okay. What matters is the relative signs of the two things. Anyway, so for minus x, we could write something like this. Now let's say I write 1 and minus 1. And then the conjugate transpose I could write here, 1, 1, 1. So can you help me? What happens here? So let's first do, I've got to do two multiplications. So let me do this one. What do we get when we multiply those two? 1, this times this, that's 1 times 1 plus 0 times 1. 1 times 1 plus 0 times minus 1. 0 times 1 plus minus 1 times 1. 0 times 1 minus 1 times minus 1. I think I'm getting this. So now I have to do this multiplication. So can you help me? Oh, and I should remember that there was this 1 over root 2 out front, and actually there's another 1 over root 2 from there. So actually there's a half out front. So can you tell me what we get now? 1 times 1 minus 1 times 1, so that gives you a 0. 1 times 1 plus 1 times 1, that's 2. But then there's a half there, so I'll put a 1 there. And then I'll get another 1 here, and then a 0. So that is the rotation matrix for the x direction. And this you can see, you know, kind of required, it's hard to arrive at it physically. What I mean by that is, when it was vectors, we had something that rotated things around the z direction this way. And just by some common sense arguments, we could write down what it should be for x direction. Well, you just move it around. You know, the minus one goes there, the one goes there. You're basically just permuting the things. Of course, this one also we could have done formally. In the sense, we could have taken this matrix, put a u here and a u dagger here. And the unitary transformation would be one that was basically turning the z into a x prime, y into the z prime, and x into y prime. You could have tried to write a unitary transformation that does just that. You could write a matrix that does that. And done this formally. You could have multiplied in a u times this times u dagger and come out with this. It's just that you don't need to. You can write it almost by common sense. But here, it's not quite so easy. It's like, I don't see a good common sense way to get from there to there. Okay. So when you apply a magnetic field in the z direction, it appears on the diagonal as plus 1 and minus 1. That looks reasonable. After all, a magnetic moment in a magnetic field, it's like if it's along the magnetic field, it has energy in one direction. If it's opposite to the magnetic field, it goes the other way. Makes good sense. On the other hand, putting it on the off diagonal here, that is not at all a intuitive thing. Okay? But that's what you arrive at if you do this. And if you do the y, that is, if we think of what would happen if you had the magnetic field in the y direction, you'd actually come up with something like this, except that instead of 1 and 1, actually this would be minus I and this would be plus I. It will still be Hermitian. Hermitian means it should be the same as its conjugate transpose. So if you have minus I there, you have a plus I there. And the way it would come about again is you could do exactly the same things. You see, you could say that if I use y and minus y as my basis, it would still look like this. but then I have to transform. So I then need matrices here with y n minus y, and that instead of 1, 1 and 1 minus 1, you'd get 1 I and 1 minus I. That's what you'd get if you go in here and put theta equals 90 degrees and phi also equal to 90 degrees, because now we are talking of the y direction. For the y direction, theta is 90, phi is also 90. And that's why the components become complex. Okay. And if you did that, and in this case, you actually have to be careful. You know, I always make this point about how I keep track of which one to put here and which one to put there, you know, how I match this and this. Now, this is one case where it doesn't matter, because this looks the same as that. So even if you didn't think about it, you'd get it right, even if you messed it up. But with the y direction, when you do it, if you don't put the right things here and here, you'd get it all wrong. Because, you know, i's are involved, and what's here is not the same as what's there. It is a little bit different. So you'd actually have to do it right. But if you did all that, you'd get this. And so these would then be what are called the, what we call the rotation matrix. So for Rx, we had something like this. The corresponding thing, sigma x, looks something like this, 0, 1, 1, 0. And there's a sigma y that looks something like this. Okay. And we have written a Rz and a Rx, and we could write a Ry as well. That's intuitive almost, as I said. You just have to permute these things around. That's easy enough. Okay. Now, so what do these have in common, really? This way of doing it with, you know, writing rotations in terms of vectors and trying to represent these rotations in terms of spinors. Here you have matrices looking like this, with no particular simple physical interpretation, really. And the way we got from here to there, or here to there, is by using this unitary transformation, which was based on telling you to accept this in the first place. Although I never quite said where this came from. I said, only if you accept this, then all this kind of follows. Okay? Now, if you read a standard quantum mechanics text, the way the argument is made, and this is why I want to connect up so you can look at the standard books, and the way the argument usually is made is this. You see, what these have in common is the following. That if you look at these rotation matrices, they follow this rule. And that is, if you take Rz, Rx, that's this matrix that rotates you around z, and the matrix that rotates you around x. And if you look at Rx, Rz, this is where, again, it's rotation around x and z, but in the opposite order. And the thing is, those two are not equal. Rotation has this property of being what we call non-commutative. That is, if you do one rotation after another, if you do it in the reverse order, it doesn't get you the same vector. There's a difference. But the thing is, that difference is actually equal to Ry. And this is, and of course, you could write the similar things for, you know, if you write Rx, Ry minus Ry, Rx, that would be equal to Rz, etc. Now, what you can prove to yourself is using these matrices. Just multiply them out, write it out, and you'll see this works. See? You know, we have a 3 by 3 matrix for Rz. We have a 3 by 3 matrix here and a 3 by 3 matrix there. And you could write it out. It's a relatively simple multiplication. You can show yourself it works. And usually the arguments start from this group theoretical argument that this is what kind of defines the algebra of rotations. That if you are trying to define, you know, construct this conceptual scheme where you're going to take these vectors and represent them with 3 by 3 components, then the first thing you need to find is these three matrices, Rx, Ry, and Rz. You have to find 3 3 by 3 matrices which obey this algebra. That will then allow you to take one of these quantities and rotate them around these three axes. And of course, if you can rotate them around x, y, and z axis, then you can rotate around any arbitrary axis. You would actually just, if you want to rotate around something pointing in a particular direction n, you'd just have to take r dot n, where r is r by, when I write r vector, what I mean is its x component is rx, y component is ry, and z component is rz. Okay. So you could then rotate it around any axis, and the point is, as long as this basic algebra is satisfied by those matrices, you'd have a consistent theory. Now, because, you know, the question that would bother you is, where does this come from? Now, I said that if you accept this, everything else follows. You don't have to accept anything else if you accept this one. And the way the argument usually would go is that, okay, so as long as I have matrices like this, you'll have a consistent theory. So if I really want to represent this object with two complex components, then the first thing I need is a bunch of 2x2 matrices, 2x2 complex matrices that obey an algebra like this. And then they would argue that, let me take this off, that what needs to be discovered is 2x2 matrices like this, which obey that algebra. And what can be shown is that, you know, sigma z, sigma x, minus sigma x, sigma z is equal to sigma y. Actually, not quite. There's a 2i here. Why the 2i? Because if you compared, you know, what I just erased with what you have here, there's this extra I here, and also there was that extra factor of 2. That's why, actually, if you divide by 2i in order to have the equivalent there. Okay. Anyway, so, and if you multiply through by 2i, what you'd get is something like this. So here again, what you can check is that if you write down these three matrices, which you have up there, sigma z, sigma x, and sigma y, it will obey this algebra. So you can, let's try it right now. So sigma z is 0, minus 1. Sigma x is 0, 1, 1, 0. And if you multiply those two, what you'd get is 0, I think, 1, minus 1, 0. If I do sigma x, sigma z, that means I'm going to multiply them the other way. Then what you'd get is, so when you multiply the two, when you subtract one from the other, what do you get? Right. So you'd get 0, 2, minus 2, 0, which you could write as 2i. And 0 minus I plus I, 0. So what I just tried to show you is sigma z sigma x minus sigma x sigma z is 2i sigma y. Okay? Which you can check. So as I said, if you read a standard chapter on spins in any quantum mechanics text, that's how it would go. They start from this idea of the rotation group. They would say that in order to have these 2x2 representations, first thing you need is a set of 2x2 complex matrices which obeys this algebra. And one choice for that is this. The choice isn't completely unique. You could have found another set which would have that algebra and which would be fine. It's just the convention is to use this. This is what's known as the polyspin matrices. And these matrices then obey this algebra. And once you have this, then one could, where do you get this from? Well, the argument is that if you want a spin that's pointing along the z direction, an up spin or a down spin, what are those? Those are actually the eigenvectors of that matrix. The eigenvectors of this matrix are, what are the eigenvectors of this matrix? Can you help me? 1, 0 and 0, 1. What are the eigenvalues? 1 and minus 1. Plus 1 and minus 1. So those are the eigenvalues and those are the corresponding eigenvectors. What about this one? What are the eigenvalues? This one is not quite so obvious, but you can check. It's also plus 1 and minus 1. Actually, all those have exactly the same eigenvalues. So when you put a magnetic field, no matter what direction you put it in, there will always be two states, one plus mu bb, another minus mu bb. Doesn't matter what direction the field is, which is, of course, reassuring. I mean, after all, there's nothing special about any of those three directions. So whether you take have a magnetic field in the z direction and find the eigenvalues, or whether it's this and you find the eigenvalues, and whether it's this, you'd get exactly the same eigenvalues. One would be going up by plus, and another would be going down. But the eigenvectors will be completely different. So in this case, the eigenvectors are 1, 0, 0, 1. In this case, the eigenvectors are 1, 1 and 1, minus 1. Those are, of course, what you call the up spin along x and the up spin and down spin along x. Those are the eigenvectors of that matrix. Right? And that's what you'd get. And what I tried to give you here was the general expression. But if you had a vector pointing in any direction defined by theta and phi, its up and down components are given by this. If you want x, you just put phi equal to 0, theta equals 90 degrees. If you want y, you put theta equals 90 degrees and phi equals 90 degrees, etc. And here the eigenvectors are, you can show, I think would be 1 I and 1 minus I. And you should remember, of course, that eigenvectors are not completely unique in the sense you can always multiply this by any complex number here. And that's okay. That's acceptable. So if two people have two different things that differ by a complex thing multiplying them, that makes, that's fine. That's always okay. And only thing just to often you normalize these, in which case these should be divided by square root of 2, etc. Okay. And in general, then, if you wanted the eigenvectors along some direction n, you know, some direction n defined by, you know, the x component is sine theta, cosine phi, sine theta, sine phi, and cosine theta. So if you want to find the eigenvectors along a particular, for the, this direction, what you're supposed to do then is take sigma dot n. And by that, I mean sigma x times this, plus sigma y times that, plus sigma z times that, and find its eigenvectors. And that's what would look like this. That's what you could write in this form, in general. Now, why is it that the eigenvectors of this one give you the up and down along x? Well, because, remember, this matrix is what allows you to rotate around the x-axis. So if you have something that's pointing along x, then rotating around x doesn't do anything to it. And that's what an eigenvector is. Eigenvector of this matrix means when I take that vector, multiply it by that, I still get the same vector back. And that's why the eigenvectors of this are the things that are pointing along that direction. You see? Because this is the matrix for rotating around x. Similarly, this is the matrix for rotating around y. And so its eigenvectors basically point along y, you know, either plus y or minus y, those would be the vectors. So this is, of course, a very, you know, new concept for, I'm sure, most of you, and takes time to get used to it, right? But I think, yeah, let me stop here today, and what we'll do is apply it to different contexts and hopefully get clearer.